Welcome to the Not Old Better Show, Smithsonian Associates Series. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang, and this is episode number 199. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series, our guest today on the Not Old Better Show is Richard Bell. Author, historian Richard Bell examines the American Revolution from the point of view of those colonists who remained staunchly loyal to Britain and the Crown.
So when we think of the American Revolution's loyalists, I guess if we think of them at all, we tend to stereotype them as sycophantic, as cowardly, and as selfish rich people, usually fat cat merchants, pretentious petty aristocrats, or government officials like tax collectors. And I don't think it usually crosses our minds to consider that remaining loyal to the British Empire might just have been a sensible, even attractive choice, not just for the wealthy, but for ordinary people too. So my talk at the Smithsonian this month tries to make sense of the American Revolution from the perspective of these loyalists, especially those loyalists on some of the lower rungs of the social ladder.
That, of course, is our guest today, author, historian Richard Bell. Richard Bell has written the book We Shall Be No More: Suicide and Self-Government in the Newly United States. And his new book is titled The Blackest Market: Kidnapping, Slavery, and Salvation. Richard Bell will be at the Smithsonian Associates Program presenting The Wrong Side of History: Loyalists in the American Revolution. Please join me in welcoming to the Not Old Better Show via Skype, Richard Bell. Richard Bell, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us briefly about your upcoming Smithsonian Associates presentation.
So I'm giving a talk about the experience of being a loyalist during the American Revolution. This was not, of course, a popular position to hold during the American Revolution, particularly as the war came to an end and it became obvious that the Patriots, not the British and their loyalist allies, that the Patriots were going to be the ones to be victorious. There was a considerable cost to being a loyalist during the American Revolution, to holding fast to the belief that it made better sense for the American colonies to remain part of the British Empire rather than strike out on their own as a set of independent colonies, a set of independent nations acting together as a confederacy, as a new republic, perhaps. That seemed very bold, very ambitious, if not foolhardy or dangerous to many people, many of them a bit more conservative than some of the more adventurous members of the Patriot movement. So there was a clash then of ideas, of beliefs, of hopes about the future, about the role they could play in the world, whether as independent actors or members of an empire which was the largest and most powerful the world had ever seen. And I think understanding that clash, reconstructing that clash, reminding ourselves that the outcome of the revolution was not preordained, it was not certain to people on the ground, reminding ourselves that there was a real alternative to the American Revolution, which was to stay as part of the British Empire, helps to make what the revolution led to, the creation of the United States, that much more interesting, contingent, and potentially exciting.
A clash, a cost, maybe some sort of conservative nature, but why were so many Americans even bitterly opposed to a break with Britain and the Crown? Dive into that. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. There's a couple of ways we could approach that issue. The first is the question of how many. One of the things that scholars have really wrestled with over the last 50 or so years of studying the experience of loyalists in the American Revolution is a very simple question. How many loyalists were there? You might be familiar with an old quote from John Adams that often gets misunderstood, where he seems to suggest that maybe a third, maybe a fifth, maybe a quarter of the American Revolution, of the population during the era of the American Revolution were loyalists, that maybe a third were also neutral, and maybe a third were patriot. That's been a sort of guiding ratio for scholars who've studied this, but its accuracy remains in doubt. All we can say for sure is that we know at least 19,000 Americans took up arms and served in loyalist regiments fighting against the Patriots during the war itself. We know that at least 60,000 Americans evacuated the 13 colonies when the British Army did, and started new lives either in Britain or in other British colonies, including those in the Caribbean and notably in Canada, and then also on the west coast of Africa. But we also get the sense, and this is more anecdotal than quantitative, that the amount of harassment and intimidation leveled against people who held loyalist ideas or exhibited loyalist sympathies during the war years meant that a great many people who might have held those beliefs privately were very reluctant to express them publicly and preferred to be regarded as neutrals or those with mild reservations about the Patriot cause. You know, this was a civil war of sorts, and because one side won and the other side eventually lost, counting the losers is actually much harder than it might first appear.
Just the sheer number of people of the loyalists is large. I am always amazed at that number. And there are stereotypes about those people. There are myths, even, as those who might be selfish or cowardly or as sycophantic people. Tell us a little bit about those people specifically and how the stereotypes and myths just probably aren't as accurate as they could be.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's an important point to raise. I think we have stereotypes for a reason. They serve ideological purposes in most conflicts of this type. And of course, there will be people on the loyalist side who fit that stereotype, just as there'll be people on the patriot side who might have fit that stereotype just as well. What I like to tell my audiences when I'm talking about the loyalists is that what it meant to be a loyalist was fundamentally a fairly simple belief. The simple belief that people in the American colonies were better off if they remain part of the British Empire instead of breaking away from it. Now, making that point was simply a matter of common sense for many loyalists, and there were many loyalist pamphleteers who made just that point in print, often in response to Patriot pamphlets, most famously in response to Tom Paine's extraordinary pamphlet, Common Sense, published in January 1776. That produced a raft of rebuttals from loyalists of various stripes who argued that it was fantastic to think, fantastic to believe, nonsensical to believe that a bunch of independent tiny places, former colonies of the British Empire, could strike out on their own and expect to meet with economic success. More narrowly and more immediately, many of the early loyalist pamphleteers simply didn't think that the Patriots could win in a military struggle against the world's largest and best-funded fighting machine. To take on the Royal Navy, let alone the British Army, seemed like a fool's errand to many loyalist pamphleteers, and they encouraged their patriot countrymen to look for peace, to look for what was called reconciliation, to make some sort of deal to improve the terms under which the colonies were treated, but stopped far short of turning their back on the British Empire and everything it could offer them in terms of free trade and economic and military protection.
Tell us one of those stories, or a couple of those stories.
So one story I think that represents, or rather complicates, our understanding of who the loyalists were has a strong religious dimension. A man called Jacob Bailey was an Anglican missionary living in Maine, and his opposition to the Patriot cause was actually on religious grounds. I said he was an Anglican missionary, an Anglican minister. Like all Anglican ministers, he'd sworn what he regarded as a sacred oath to the king, who of course was also the head of the Anglican Church, the Church of England. So for him to renounce that allegiance and to undo that sacred oath by embracing the Patriot cause seemed to Jacob Bailey to be an act both of treason, but also an act of religious sacrilege, and he wouldn't do it. But he was under a lot of pressure to do just that, to renounce that oath and to embrace the Patriot cause. So maintaining his loyalty proved to be a constant struggle. The patriots, who he regarded not as patriots but as rebels, the rebels tried all manner of tactics to try to make Jacob Bailey break his oath and join in the rebellion. So, for instance, when Bailey refused to participate in a special day of Thanksgiving declared by the local Patriot Provincial Congress up in Maine, Maine rebels threatened to put up a liberty pole in front of Jacob Bailey's church and then to whip him there if he failed to bless their liberty pole, which was a symbol of the Patriot cause. And there's more. On another occasion, he came home to find that the Patriots, the rebels, had slaughtered 7 of his sheep and that a fine cow of his had been shot dead in his field. This went on and on. By 1778, which is, what, 3 years into the war, this Anglican clergyman wrote that, quote, "I have been twice assaulted by a furious mob, 4 times hauled before an unfeeling patriot committee. 3 times have I been driven from my family. 2 attempts have been made to shoot me." So to this guy, to Jacob Bailey, the patriots, these rebels, were really nothing more than thugs. He called them a set of surly and savage beings who have power in their hands and murder in their hearts, who thirst and pant and roar for the blood of those who have any connection with or affection for Great Britain. And that was in 1778. A year later, he says enough of this. And Bailey and his family, he has a wife and young children, actually flee the colony of Maine for the safety of another British colony, Nova Scotia, which was in Canada and which was not in open rebellion. And they have to go there by sea. They go basically in the clothes they're standing up in. It takes them 2 weeks to make that sea voyage. They leave almost everything they own behind them, not just their home, but also their savings, every worldly possession. But getting to Nova Scotia makes them extraordinarily thankful. And when Jacob Bailey sees the British flag flying over the town of Halifax, Nova Scotia, as his ship finally sails into the bustling port of Halifax, the Baileys are rejoicing. Jacob Bailey later wrote about that experience, and he said, "Thank God for guiding me and my family to this retreat of freedom and security from the rage of tyranny and the cruelty of oppression." So think about that last quote. Mm-hmm. To think of the British Empire as a refuge of freedom and security, to think of Patriot America as a place that for Jacob Bailey was a place of tyranny, a place of cruelty, a place of oppression, is to start to see the American Revolution from the Loyalist perspective, a perspective in which the Loyalists are, to their own minds, the true patriots, and in which their anti-crown enemies are not patriots at all. They're actually traitorous rebels.
Powerful. We are with Richard Bell. Richard Bell will be presenting at the Smithsonian Associates program, The Wrong Side of History, Loyalists in the American Revolution. Richard Bell, we're so grateful for your time, and I know you're very busy. I want to shift gears for just a moment and ask you a couple questions about some of your writing and a book I found titled "We Shall Be No More Suicide and Self-Government in the Newly United States." In that book, I noticed that you write that globally and many times in history, there are instances and rates of suicide that have been symbolic for making statements about society. Do suicide rates increase in times of socio-political crisis? And if so, why and what does that mean?
So the answer I might give if we were talking about suicide rates in the modern era is probably different from the answer I want to give when we're studying American history. My book, We Shall Be No More, is about suicide and responses and reactions to suicide between the Revolution and the Civil War. And I've got to tell you that the statistics that they had in those days, and there really weren't many statistics to speak of at all, the statistics they had are not worth the paper they're printed on. In terms of there being an accurate count of the number of people who committed suicide in any given period between the revolution and the civil war. I'm just too skeptical of the various underreporting and biases of the way those statistics were collected to say with any accuracy whether the frequency of suicide rose or fell in any given year. But what I can say, and this is what the book actually gets at, is that the newspapers, which were often how people got news about not just their local community, but the regional, national, and international community, the newspapers were full of stories of suicide between the revolution and the Civil War. And they seemed to be getting more full of these sorts of reporting of people who made the decision to die with every year that goes by. So if all you read was not government statistics or church burial records, but if all you read was your newspaper, you would certainly be of the belief that in the decades after the American Revolution, suicide seemed to be increasingly common. It seemed to be something that seemed to be threatening ever more of the people in your life, both directly and indirectly. And that sort of reporting, which accumulated for various reasons, which have little to do with the actual frequency of suicide itself and more to do with changes in the newspaper industry, that sort of reporting made many people nervous, as you might imagine. To believe that you're living through the middle of a suicide surge, a moral panic about suicide, leads you to wonder, what is it about the new country that you've built? What is it about the economy that you're constructing? What is it about the social relations which are changing rapidly as you move away from colonial understandings of hierarchy towards something that can better represent a Republican state of being? What is it about the way you're living which is causing so many people apparently to opt out, to say no, to offer a vote of no confidence in the new republic, the new society you've built? So my book is about how people responded to the perception that suicide was running rampant and out of control. And as you might imagine, conservatives in particular, and I mean that in the social sense rather than the political sense, responded with an array of reactions to try to slow the pace of social change. So it makes for an interesting, again, clash of ideas about the present and the future, when you look at those visions for the present and the future through the lens of people's concerns about self-destruction.
Yes, yes, very interesting. Of equal interest, I found some of your writing entitled, and I think this is a title of a maybe a new book of yours entitled "The Blackest Market: Kidnapping, Slavery, and Salvation." I thought that was just a fascinating title too, and so tell us a little bit about that writing of yours and what that means in our history.
So I'm at work on a new book, which is a true life story about the enslavement, forced migration, and then recovery and rescue of five free black boys who were kidnapped from the streets of Philadelphia in August of 1825 by a gang of professional kidnappers who made their living spiriting away free black children from the streets of northern cities like Philadelphia and Baltimore, and then selling them to planters setting up new plantations in the deep, deep south, what's now called the Cotton Kingdom. New planters were rushing into places like Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi in the 1820s. They wanted to make their fortunes growing cotton and sometimes sugar. They needed a workforce to do that. And part of the supply of that workforce came from kidnapped free people. Your listeners, I'm sure, are probably familiar, Paul, with the Oscar-winning movie from 2013, 12 Years a Slave, mm-hmm. which for me is, first of all, a wonderful piece of art, mm-hmm. But it's also based on a true story, of course. It's based on the true story of Solomon Northup, who was kidnapped as an adult from New York State and trafficked into slavery in Louisiana. He spent 12 years there before fighting his way back to freedom and writing a book about his experiences. That book and that movie have been really useful in shining a spotlight on the existence of this trade and traffic in kidnapped free people into Southern slavery in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s. But there's one way in which that book and that movie are not actually representative of the larger phenomenon. And that is that Northup was an adult man when he was kidnapped. Most of the people that were kidnapped into slavery and sent south on these forced migrations, these free black people, were usually children. My boys, the five boys I'm writing about, and again, this is a real case from the newspapers and court records of the 1820s. My boys, the oldest is 15, the youngest is 6. So kidnapping street children for professional kidnappers was actually a lot easier than trying to kidnap and subdue and spirit away adult people like Solomon Northup. So they chose children in overwhelming numbers. And very rarely did those folks, whether they were children like the ones I'm writing about or adults like Solomon Northup, very rarely did they make it back out of slavery to then give some account of their experience. And in the case of the boys I'm writing about, they actually give testimony to the mayor of Philadelphia, who pours extraordinary, unprecedented resources in trying to round up, capture, arrest, and punish some of the kidnappers involved in this particular case.
That, too, is an interesting subject. And Richard Bell, I'd love to have you come back and talk about that as you get that book closer to its final publishing date. I know our audience will love that. But Richard Bell, recipient of the 2017 University System of Maryland Board of Regents Faculty Award for Excellence in Teaching, the highest honor for teaching faculty in the Maryland state system, will be at the Smithsonian Associates Program presenting The Wrong Side of History, Loyalists in the American Revolution. Richard Bell, thanks so much for your time. This is fascinating. I could talk to you for a long time, Richard Bell.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Really appreciate it. My thanks to our guest today, Richard Bell, who will be at the Smithsonian Associates Program presenting The Wrong Side of History, Loyalists in the American Revolution in Washington, D.C. My thanks as well to the Smithsonian team for all they do to support our interviews. As usual, we'll post links to everything, and also as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me. I'm always interested in your feedback, and you can leave that at iTunes, Google Play, or send me email at info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about Better, the Not Old Better show. Thanks, everybody. Oh, and remember, check out genealogybank.com/NOBS for great genealogy newspaper articles, history, and data, and to support the show. That's genealogybank.com/NOBS. And finally, the music today is from the Free Music Archive, performed by the United States Army Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps. Thanks so much, everybody.